you take, let us assume, a third toke, long and slow. You vaporize, and you take it in and in and in, and there is a sound like the crumpling of a plastic bread wrapper, or the crackling, or the blame, or the and a tone, and a tone, a
All right, you're listening to Kootenai Corp Radio 93.5 FM CJLY, broadcasting live from Nelson and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicorpradio.com.
There is a cheer. The gnomes have learned a new way to say who.
Welcome, listeners. This is Fane of the Cosmos.
Infinite Moment.
I'm one of your hosts, Dustin Sunflower.
I'm another one of your hosts, Reverend DeMuzzi.
And on tonight's show, we'll be talking about Indonesian death penalty and how people in other countries actually could face having their heads lopped off for drug trafficking.
Yeah, and we'll also be hopefully talking with David Malmo Levine about the tsunami. He has an interesting theory that the tsunami may have been, artificially induced for the purpose of securing the world's oil in that region. And we'll also have an interview with David Gross, who's the editor and republisher of Fitzhugh Ludlow's work, The Annotated Hashish Eater. And that should be interesting as well.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be awesome. We should maybe even have a Terrence McKenna clip on that one. We'll be talking about... what else did I have there all lined up? Anyway, some really funny comedy clips are going to be coming up. And, gee whiz, I can't think... Oh, yeah, Bad Cop No Donut will be coming up. What else, Dan? Come on.
I don't know. I think that's squeezing it. I was thinking I might talk about gay marriage at some point here, just because that's a big debate. It was raging on the CBC earlier today.
Gay marriage, hey?
Yeah, I mean...
What does that have to do with drugs?
I want to fight for the right for me and my girlfriend to have a gay marriage.
All right. Here we go, folks. This is Fane of the Cosmos. And if you're listening on Kootenai Lake, you're listening to 96.5 FM.
Mind-altering psychedelic trip.
All right, welcome back, listeners. This is Fane of the Cosmos, and in a story that stuns the world, really, an Australian woman may face the death penalty for marijuana charges in, of all places, Bali. A stunningly beautiful young Australian woman who recently tested negative to all drug tests forced upon her now sits alone in a cold, dark cell somewhere in Bali awaiting her trial date to be set and to hear whether or not she will be executed. 27-year-old Chappelle Lee Corby has been charged with smuggling marijuana into Bali, which seems pretty ridiculous because Bali has a good enough marijuana scene in its own right. The icy cold drug detectives assigned to her case say they recommend the prosecutors try Ms. Corby under Indonesia's nasty narcotics law number 82, which carries the maximum penalty of death for those convicted of importing drugs into Bali. On October 8, 2004, Ms. Corby was caught with 4.2 kilos of marijuana in her luggage at an airport in Bali. Ms. Corby insists the marijuana was not hers, and her family and legal team insist the marijuana was planted in her bag. This seems likely due to the fact that marijuana is usually smuggled out of Bali rather than into Bali because the prices for pot in Bali are much lower than prices for pot in Australia. In addition, the cannabis was found in a clear plastic bag in plain view for all to see when her bag was unzipped at the airport. Prosecutors in Indonesia, a country which places marijuana in the same category as heroin, in turn have commented that they are seeking to make a public example out of Ms. Corby. It's a drug case and it must be the toughest, so it will be intimidate others who try to copy her, said Lieutenant Colonel Bambang Sugiarto. Ms. Corby's trial could take place by the end of the month. Let's take action to save her life before it's too late. So if you want to... She's one of a few people who are in Bali right now and are facing these kinds of, facing execution. There's also two other guys. Maybe they're not as cute as her, but anyway, there's people who are facing the death penalty, male and female. But we've got to get out there and get some action. Write to the Australian Prime Minister or the Australian Minister of Affairs and ask them to get their asses moving to protect these people. You can contact the Indonesian consulate in Australia and get them rolling, and contact the Indonesian government and tell them that execution is no way to deal with someone who was framed. Now, we're going to go to a track here. This is Bad Cop No Donut for this week, and when we get back, we might just have an interview for you. Here we go, Bad Cop No Donut.
This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of January 20th, 2005.
All right, police!
Bad Cop
No Donut!
Bad. Cop.
Donut!
Cause I'm the law! And I rule!
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. A police officer in Freehold, New Jersey, has pleaded not guilty to forcing a woman to perform a sex act on him in his squad car in April 2004. Officer Dennis Smith is accused of placing the woman in his patrol car after a traffic stop, driving the woman to a remote location, and then forcing her to perform a sex act. Smith is charged with 3 counts of sexual assault, 2 counts of official misconduct, and 2 counts of first-degree kidnapping. The officer has been suspended without pay pending the outcome of his trial, which is scheduled to resume in March. A veteran police officer in Athens, Alabama, has resigned amid allegations of sexual misconduct. Officer Lee Kennemer quit his job after 4 women inmates came forward claiming they had sex with 3 different officers in the Athens department against their will. An investigation into the allegations is now closed, and the results have not been made public. By quitting the department, Kennemer will keep his retirement benefits. A man who says he was beaten and hogtied by a Las Vegas police officer during a traffic stop almost 2 years ago has filed a lawsuit against the Las Vegas Department. The man pulled his car over after it ran out of gas in February 2003 and was confronted by the officer who ordered him to lay down before beating and handcuffing the man. The man woke up several hours later in jail, lying in a pool of blood. Workers at the detention center showed deliberate indifference to the man's constitutional rights. The man is seeking $10,000 in damages. A police officer in Toronto who had been found guilty of assaulting a man during a wrongful arrest was given a conditional discharge by a judge this week and will have no criminal record. The officer, William Walker, was found guilty at his trial last October. All charges against the officer's victim were dropped. At the sentencing, the judge praised the officer's professional achievements before he sent an armed criminal out to protect and serve the people of Toronto. The victim of the beating is moving forward with his plans to sue the officer and the department for $1.6 million Canadian dollars. The sentence comes as no surprise to Toronto residents who last year watched in amazement while four police officers who beat a man to death outside of a convenience store were acquitted of their manslaughter charges. Ongoing RCMP corruption investigations have led to charges against more than a dozen officers and the closing down of the plainclothes unit of a downtown police division. Since that time, the Toronto Department has been looking at ways to restore public confidence. This week, it was announced that all officers in high-risk jobs will have to undergo drug testing, psychological evaluations, and have their bank accounts probed. The association representing the officers has vowed to oppose the new measures, which are set to begin on March 1st. In a related story, Toronto police killed a 34-year-old man last week after executing a warrant on the victim's home. Police used a taser to subdue the man, and an ambulance was called around 40 minutes after the man had become unconscious and had difficulty breathing. Also, two people were injured this week when a vehicle being chased by Toronto police left the street and struck two pedestrians. Nearly a year after the fact, a Nome, Alaska police officer is finally on trial this week for murdering a teenage woman. Matthew Clay Owens was charged with the murder by Alaska state troopers who were called in to investigate the crime. Owens is charged with first-degree murder and evidence tampering. The tampering charge is in relation to some false evidence, a staged theft of his police cruiser in order to clear himself of suspicion in the killing. During the investigation, it was discovered that Owens had engaged in sexual activity with several women while he was on duty and had sex with at least one of them in his patrol car. Owens was on duty at the time of the murder, one of only two officers on duty at the time the victim was shot in the back of the head and left at an abandoned mine.
He just started yelling at me. He's like, "You're not supposed to be here anyways. Go back into your office."
He just started searching me and didn't give me any reasons for stopping me. And then they arrest me. They probably thought that I was selling drugs or something like that. I call 911.
It's going to be our war against his work, and they are on the low.
They've earned every last penny of that cash.
Do you have any hope of recovering the money?
No.
A family in Chicago says that $13,000 of their money went missing after a police search of their home. After pulling over and arresting a man who was guilty of being Latino and driving to his job in a Cadillac, police decided to search the man's home. After the search, the officers left and released the man. Shortly afterwards, the family discovered that the money was missing and called police to complain. The police only launched an investigation after an intervention by a local television station who had been following the robbery. The family is not expecting to get their money back. Police in the city of Benton Harbor, Michigan, which has been the scene of rioting by residents over past incidents of police brutality, will soon have cameras in their cars to monitor their behavior. The mayor of the city is insisting on the action after being inundated with complaints of misconduct by the city's officers from residents. Meanwhile, the chief of the local department says that he is not aware of any misconduct on the part of his officers. A recent complaint by two men who were stopped by police alleges that they were not released until they allowed officers to look inside of their underwear, ostensibly for drugs. The city also plans to hire a community relations officer to investigate future complaints against officers. A grand jury indicted a Lincoln, Illinois police officer and her husband on drug charges after their home was raided last month and several dozen marijuana plants were found growing. The charges were handed down on Friday. Officer Diana Short is charged with unlawful manufacture of between 500 and 2,000 grams of marijuana, unlawful manufacture of marijuana with intent to deliver, unlawful production of between 20 and 50 marijuana plants, two charges of official misconduct, and one count of making a false affidavit. Officer Short resigned from the force, and she and her husband are both currently free on bond. A man in Brookline, New Hampshire, who had tried to kill his wife, had all charges against him dropped this week when police failed to show up at a hearing. Officer Anthony Corrado says he did not appear at the hearing because he had not seen the notification. Prosecutors will attempt to file new charges, but the man's family fears that he will make bail on unrelated charges in the meantime.
I'd like to make it very clear that I would not tolerate any member of this agency to conduct themselves in such a way as to bring dishonor to this department or to the law enforcement community as a whole.
A police officer in Baldwin, Florida, has been fired after several allegations were made of inappropriate sexual behavior toward teenage boys. Officer James Lawrence was fired after two teenagers came forward after a New Year's Eve party at the officer's house, claiming that Lawrence had touched them in an inappropriate manner. Another young person was found during the ensuing investigation who claimed that the officer had made sexually suggestive remarks almost 1 year ago. So far, no criminal charges have been filed against the officer. Last week, a police officer in Dayton, Kentucky, pleaded guilty to charges of official misconduct. Sergeant Rally Barnett was sentenced to 6 months in jail and will not be allowed to work as a police officer anywhere in the United States ever again. The officer had hired two officers with questionable histories in law enforcement, including an officer who was accused of sexual abuse of a child. A man who was mistakenly shot by Middletown, Pennsylvania police officers last February has had his lawsuit settled out of court. The man was in bed naked and unarmed when police stormed into his apartment looking for his brother. The man was shot by Officer Dale Keddy, who was not in uniform at the time of the shooting, and claims he mistook the T-shirt the man was using to cover his genitals for a weapon. The man is confined to a wheelchair and is being fitted for a prosthetic leg. Details of the settlement have not been disclosed. A teacher in El Paso, Texas, along with five students, has filed a police brutality lawsuit relating to excessive force used by police on students at a high school. The students had walked out of class in January 2003 to protest changes to their class schedule. When police arrived, there was a verbal and then physical confrontation with the students that left many of them injured. Monetary damages are being sought in addition to changes in police training. A loophole in a Florida law has led to charges being dropped against a police officer in Bradenton who had sex with a jail inmate. The law that deals with charges of sexual abuse of inmates only mentions corrections officers specifically. Therefore, the prosecutor has dropped charges against Officer Prince Milton, saying that there was not a statute under which the officer could be charged. A police officer in La Porte, Texas, has been suspended after it was claimed that he beat up two women. In December, Officer Carl Davis was accused of giving a woman two black eyes in an incident where he punched and choked her. Another woman has come forward alleging that Davis shoved her against her car and maced her in May 2003 after she asked him why he had pulled her over. An internal investigation is underway. Other than the murders already mentioned, police also killed people this week in Fremont, California, Virginia Beach, Virginia, La Habra, California, and Nashville, Tennessee. That's all for this week. Tune into this station next week for more. Email your comments and story ideas to ihatepigs@hotmail.com. That's all one word. From CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, I'm Ron Anisich. Each week we end Bad Cop No Donut with a song. This week, it's Let's Kill All Cops by MDC.
Kill the cops!
All right. That was Bad Cop, No Donut. And I'm not into killing anybody, so we don't need to kill cops. Let's,
Yeah, it's a little aggro, buddy.
I know. Well, it's not my radio segment. This is from CKLN in Toronto with Ron... No, wait a second. I can't remember his name. But anyway, we're not of the opinion that anybody should be killing cops. If we can win them over to our side, then we have an ally. If we kill them off, we're down one ally.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is, anytime you use violence as like a force against those who, yeah. you know, who you imagine to be your, you know, enemies, you just create more. You know, you're basically reinforcing that whole paradigm and creating more of that, you know, them us kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's no good.
No good. So anyway, Fane of the Cosmos does not support killing cops. But you will be happy to know that there is a program underway called Shave the Hippies. The food cupboard every year goes through the hardest times, and not the actual food cupboard itself, but people are depending heavily on the food cupboard in January and February. And there's a fundraiser going on right now where you can make donations to the food cupboard, and if they raise $500, they're going to shave off the beards of the holy smokers.
Well, for the second there, I thought you were going to tell me they were going to shave off your beards with hopes of finding enough food to feed the homeless in Nelson.
No, no, but we are hoping to make one futon bed out of the beard hair. No.
That'll be a nice comfy place for someone to sleep at night.
We'd have to defumigate first, of course. No, but folks, if you've ever wanted to defoliate a hippie, this is the best way to do it. If we can raise $500... we will be defoliated. The holy smokers. Paul DeFelice, the last time his beard was shaved was 1990. Alan Middlemiss. Dustin Camwell. You could see us as shorn men. So if we raise $500. So get out there, make a pledge today. Pledge sheets are at Holy Smoke. They're around town. If you see me on the street, hit me up. We need to raise money for the food bank because a lot of money went to the tsunami relief, and it's kind of left the coffers dry for local projects. So if we can get some loot to the food cupboard, that is crucial because, these are the hardest months and the liberal funding's been cut. So let's get out there, and in the deal, you could have some hippies with clean-shaven faces. They may even... make us have showers. You never know.
Wow. That'd be something.
I know.
Okay, so our next interview is with David Gross. And he's the editor of a book by Fitzhugh Ludlow that was originally published in 1857 called The Hashish Eater. His work is called The Annotated Hashish Eater. And it's available on CD. And it's sort of like a, if you take Fitzhugh Ludlow's original work and you put it on CD with tons of references and all kinds of supporting material, basically it's a full-on historical lesson about the significance of this person, Fitzhugh Ludlow, and his work. And I can't really emphasize enough how amazing his work is, but I won't go on about it. We're going to call.
Well, he was one of those first premier people to ever write about trips, like a trip on hashish, or it could be compared to there was some, the Opium Eater, the Tales of an Opium Eater.
Exactly.
Like there was very few. There's that very came out few. First. There's very few historical kind of art chronicles of the ingestion of psychedelics in our culture, like by European folks. So maybe the Club de Hashashin in Paris and that kind of thing, but not a lot of personal experiences. I read the Tales of an Opium Eater, and it was pretty. It's pretty amazing. Like, it's laudanum and the whole... But this one is, you know, to do with hashish, which is pretty surprising. You normally don't think of chewing down on a chunk of hash, but...
Well, you know what's neat about it is that it has a big historical significance. But, you know, instead of us kind of talking at great length about that. What we should probably do is give David a call. But
why don't you just say shut up, Dustin? Let's get on with the interview.
Okay, well, let's do that. But before we do that, let's play. This is an excerpt from Terrence McKenna talking about the Hashish Eater by Fitzhugh Ludlow.
By Fitzhugh Ludlow, published in 1857 by Harper and Brothers, New York. This was the first of the American hashish exposés, and many feel the best. And what I'm going to read this morning out of a very rich potential group of readings is Fitzhugh Ludlow's description of his first encounter with the power of cannabis. So I begin the reading partway through the chapter called The Night Entrance. One morning in the spring of 1850-something, I dropped in upon the doctor from my accustomed lounge. "Have you seen," said he, "my new acquisitions?" I looked toward the shelves in the direction of which he pointed and saw, added since my last visit, a row of comely pasteboard cylinders enclosing vials of the various extracts prepared by Tilden and Company. Arranged in order according to their size, they confronted me, as pretty a rank of medicinal sharpshooters as could gratify the eye of an amateur. I approached the shelves that I might take them in review. A rapid glance showed most of them to be old acquaintances. Conium, taraxacum, rhubarb. Ha! What is this? Cannabis indica? That, answered the doctor, looking with a parental fondness upon his new treasure, is a preparation of the East Indian...
Okay, folks, I don't know what happened there, but, David, are you there? Caller, are you there?
Well, we actually called him. It doesn't sound like he's there.
I'm here.
Oh, you are here. Okay. Okay, you got to talk louder.
Okay.
Cool. Okay, here, we got the dials in.
So this is David Gross, and David, you're the editor of the Hashish Eater, right? The modern editor?
Yes.
And your work is the Annotated Hashish Eater. Could you explain to us what makes the Hashish Eater relevant today? Why did you feel that it was important to republish this work?
Well, in the same way that Charles Darwin, a lot has happened since Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species, still it's very instructive for a modern biologist to go back and read and figure out what his thought processes were and how he came to the conclusions that he did. I think that Fitzhugh Ludlow is the modern psychonauts Charles Darwin, and the conclusions that he drew and the experiences he had and the questions that he asked and the descriptive skill that he took to the psychedelic experience is something that we can still learn from. Because he was the first really to get there. Well, it's not entirely true. He wasn't the first to get there. He was the first in the English language literary world to get there and come back and talk about it and take it seriously. And because of that, he didn't have the sort of, he didn't have the shortcuts and cliches that we rely on now to describe altered states of consciousness. Now it's kind of a, you know, everybody knows about it. A lot of people have experienced it. And we have a lot of, we talk about tripping, for instance, and you can use a single verb like that and describe to a lot of people, okay, I know what you mean when you're saying that. He didn't have that built-in vocabulary, and he didn't have an audience of people who had experienced these sort of altered states of consciousness before. So he had to just start from scratch and really lead people along word by word and say, this is what it was like. And so it's amazing descriptions of a sort that even though we've had generations now of people who are familiar with psychedelic drugs, the descriptions that we have today don't really compete with what he was able to come up with back then, because he had to. He was inventing the wheel.
Yeah, like instead of saying dry mouth, for example, he describes quite poetically the experience of needing to drink, you know, fountains full of water, I think, at one point. I think there's a lot of things there that we could relate to in a modern sense. But what I'm wondering is, could you put it in historical context for us?
Okay. This is the middle of the 19th century. And in the English-speaking world, there's a rumor of hashish, but there isn't a whole lot of experience with it. In the 1830s, there was a physician in India who was introduced to the drug medicinally and who wrote a treatise on it. This is W.B. O'Shaughnessy. And it became kind of a hit in the medical world, used to treat tetanus and a number of other diseases. And in the course of describing that, he alluded to the fact that the drug he was describing was the same as the hashish, which people may have heard of through the Arabian Nights, for instance. In the literary world, in the popular world outside of medical journals, hashish was just sort of an exotic thing of the Orient that people knew of the way you would know of, Sinbad or something like that. It was kind of exotic, kind of weird, but nobody really thought they would encounter it the same way they didn't think they would encounter the pharaohs who built the pyramids. But the mixture of these two things meant that eventually a collision was going to happen, and it happened to Fitzhugh Ludlow in a pharmacy, which is where he encountered it. He used to go down, and this was just his idea of fun would be go down to the pharmacy and see what they had and try a little bit of it. And his pharmacist apparently was willing to go along with this as this kid comes in. He's probably 16 or 17 years old and says, well, let's see, can I try some of that ether you've got? Let's see how that chloroform is. Is that opium? Let me give some of that a shot. And then one day, a new one came in, a cannabis lockjaw remedy, tetanus remedy called Tilden's extract. And it was, he thought of it as hashish. It was actually a much more purified version of cannabis resin than hashish is. So a very, very powerful drug. And he started doing it by the spoonful and couldn't get enough.
Well, that's interesting. Now, there's some controversy, isn't there, around Fitzhugh Ludlow's work? For example, his apparent writings under pseudonyms to journals about the hashish experience that are very similar to the writings he did under his own name, and then, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Could you tell me about that? What's going on there? Are you convinced that Fitzhugh Ludlow wrote works under a pseudonym to sort of promote his own work?
Well, the hashish eater itself was written under a pseudonym. He didn't issue it under his own name. He called it. He called himself the Pythagorean, and this was based on a theory that he had that the Pythagorean Greeks were using hashish, and that's why they were coming up with their strange ideas of the music of the spheres. Pythagoras himself was a bit of an eccentric fellow, and he had rivers talking to him and yelling out his name and that sort of thing. And Ludlow thought, well, hey, I think I know where he got his ideas. He was probably a hashish user. So that's how he released his book. He also sent an article to Putnam's Monthly that is, it's clearly his work. It talks about the Pythagoras theory, and it actually rewrites some of the chapters from the hashish eater into an article called The Apocalypse of Hashish. There's another article that was in Putnam's Magazine around the same time by a traveler to the East called Bayard Taylor, who had talked about his hashish experiences in Syria. And then there was a third, also in Putnam's Magazine, which seemed to have a little bit of a hashish craze for a little while in the middle of the 19th century. And this one was called The Hashish Eater, but it was anonymous. And it doesn't really resemble Ludlow's writing. It talks about the author having first encountered the drug in the land of the Saracen, which is the same place Bayard Taylor did. And then it goes off on a very macabre adventure that eventually ends up with him holding a knife to somebody's throat and being told by voices to kill this person and on and on. It feels kind of fictional. It feels kind of like, a Poe short story or something. It's a little bit too pat in the way that it works, and moralistic. And so I have a feeling that that one is just a matter of somebody reading about hashish and then deciding to write a short story about it.
Uh-huh.
Although it could possibly have been Ludlow, it could possibly have been Bayard Taylor.
But Ludlow, he's pretty, you know, he's pretty adamant that, you know, at least in the hashish eater anyway, that, you know, this is a true story.
Yeah.
But do you think that there may have been a bit of artistic license in there?
Well, he at times will confront that very issue in the text of the book and say, well, there's really no way to put the experiences I'm having to words. You know, and words is all I've got. So I'm going to be resorting to metaphor. And I'm going to be describing the closest thing that the English language has to the descriptions I had. And he also, in his later career as an art critic, made the same point when he was talking about somebody's art. He says, well, you can either get lost in the details and try to describe them scientifically and precisely, or you can try to poetically grasp the whole effect of something that's going on.
Some people...
And either one has its advantages. If you try to describe something in a larger sense, you may get across in a much better way what it is you're talking about, but you may end up getting a little sloppy about some of the details. If you dive into the details, well, there's something you gain from the precision, but there's something you lose in that maybe you'll just get sort of lost in details and you'll miss the forest for the trees.
Yeah. Some people think that Ludlow was exaggerating his experience because I guess that for one thing, he has some pretty extreme hallucinations.
Yes.
And another one that is that he describes addiction in a way that I've never really heard anybody describe addiction to cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that other people anyways sort of feel that way. Now, when I read yours, it seemed to me that you sort of were leaning the other way, that you were saying, well, no, I think there is a good argument for the other. Could you explain why you think that?
Well, there's two issues here. One is, why was he tripping so hard? And that is that although he was taking cannabis, he was taking extremely large doses of it. His average dose would have been the equivalent of maybe sucking down 7 joints at a time. His largest dose would have been more on the order of an ounce of marijuana at a single sitting. So this was not anything like the sort of recreational doses that people are used to today. This was very much at a hallucinatory level, and he was probably having effects that really aren't just a quantitative extension of the kind of highs people have when they smoke marijuana today. This was above and beyond that. And it's certainly expressed in the kind of hallucinations he has and experiences he had. He talks about, at one point, my ability at times to feel sights, see sounds, etc. Now, this is something that is common with psychedelics, the synesthesia, but it's not something that an ordinary person would just have happened to have stumbled across. And it's certainly not something that the average marijuana user experiences on a regular basis. So it gives you some idea of the qualitative difference in the kind of high that he was getting.
The addiction for me was particularly, I was like, wow, like he's that. You know, if you were taking doses that large and having, I would say, sometimes questionably, well, definitely unpleasurable experiences,
mm-hmm.
How could you feel like you still needed to take it? I don't know anybody who has unpleasant pot experiences who feel still compelled to take, you know, to smoke.
It's strange. And he doesn't pull any punches. He says, I was definitely hooked and had a hell of a time getting off. And when you look at his writing about it and you know what we know about cannabis today, it just seems very mysterious. And the closer I read it, it seems that he when he describes his withdrawal symptoms, he isn't describing physical symptoms at all. He's describing emotional or more or less symptoms of serious depression or... the way he describes it is he looks at the world as it is when he is sober, and it's just dead and disappointing to him that he has seen all of these amazing things, everything in his ordinary day-to-day reality has been transformed in his eyes in all of these magnificent ways, and he just feels like he can't go back. He can't go back to just looking at the sky, just looking at a sunset, just looking at a babbling brook. It isn't good enough for him anymore. And so He is at one point says that he was reduced to going out into a sunbeam and blowing bubbles and watching the colors change on the bubble, and that was as close as he was able to get to recapturing what it felt like to be having those hallucinations. But it's strange also that as time went on, the quality of his hallucinations seemed to change and become much more terrible and terrifying. And so that makes it surprising that he had a hard time kicking it. But I guess that's probably also why he eventually decided he needed to stop. He was, at that time, taking cannabis on a daily basis and being basically, you know, just high all the time and just having, you know, peaks and valleys of being high, but really being high all the time.
And I guess, you know, just reading it, I couldn't help but wonder whether or not maybe Tilden's was slipping a little opium in there just to make it, you know, to make their lockjaw remedy all that much more popular.
Mm-hmm. It's entirely possible.
And I guess the one other thing that I kind of wanted to say was that in the historical perspective, I want to know if I have this right, is that his book basically popularized hashish to the extent that after it came out, there were hashish dens opening all throughout the U.S., right?
Mm-hmm.
So this was a major work. This was like, this introduced hashish to the American people, right?
Yeah, there was a bit of a craze, both in terms of literature. You all of a sudden see every magazine has to have their hashish eater and their article about the crazy hashish eaters of the Orient or what have you. And, hashish parlors started opening up in major cities all over the place. Hashish candies were starting to be sold. John Hay, who was later going to be Lincoln's Secretary of State, read the hashish eater when he was in college and said, I've got to try some of this stuff. And so there's notoriety, if you read any biographies of him, his classmates are sure to remember that day he took hashish and what happened. So yeah, it really did become a craze for a while.
What kind of background did he have? Like, was he from a wealthy family, or like what university did he go to? That kind of thing. Like, what did his upbringing lead? How did his upbringing lead him to eventually eating hashish?
His father was a minister and an abolitionist.
Abolitionist, holy.
Yeah, in New York City, and this would have been in the 1820s, 1830s, when abolitionism wasn't popular even in the urban north in the United States. And so he was raised in an environment that was very, very biblical, in that the word of the Bible is very important, and interpreting it and trying to live by it was very important. And also, he was he was educated at home and also in the schools, and had a very early classical education. And so, as a result of that, I think this is part of the key to what makes the hashish eater successful, is that he had a tremendous vocabulary and a tremendous command of classical mythology and biblical allusions and metaphors. And so he's always got the image that he needs at his disposal when he's trying to describe something. It's remarkable to me how observant he was, how much he was able to bring back from a hashish experience, which is, cannabis is fairly notorious for messing with the memory, and he's able to have experiences of a huge variety and bring them home and then use his descriptive skill to pin them down for us.
Now, was writing his mainstay? Like, was that his livelihood?
Yeah. He wrote for after the hashish eater. It took a while to find out any of this, because the hashish eater has been out of print until my edition. It had been out of print for about 25 years.
Wow.
And the story of Fitzhugh Ludlow, it was pretty much untold, in that this was his first book. It was published when he was 21 years old, about his teenage hashish experiences. And then it is also his best-known work. So he kind of just falls off the map after that, or did. And now there are a couple of biographies out there about him. One is one that I put out on the Internet about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's a newer one by Donald P. Dolcinos called Pioneer of Inner Space, which is very thorough and very good.
Nice. Have you ever yourself tried to recreate any of his experiences?
No.
No? Okay.
No.
You've never chomped down on a huge amount of hashish and compared notes?
No, it sounds fairly terrifying. I wouldn't write it off entirely. I think I, should probably give it a shot before I die.
Yeah.
But I'm satisfied with his descriptions.
Now, have you ever been able to get in contact? I know there have been, I don't know what you would call it, archaeopharmacological digs, Have you ever found a sample of the Tidwell hashish or
Tilden's extract? It would be nice to be able to do that. I'm sure by now it would have degenerated to the point where it probably wouldn't give you as much data as you'd like.
No, do you?
We know a little bit about how it was produced.
Okay.
In that, with hashish, you've got the resin from the cannabis, flowering cannabis, and then it's combined with, ash or, some sort of medium to hold it together.
Yeah.
What Tilden's extract was made of was this resin in an alcohol extract. So it was pulling out anything that was alcohol soluble from this and evaporating the alcohol out. So it was about
hash oil, really,
cannabis as you can get.
Wow.
And he was taking it by the spoonful.
That's hash oil.
I can't even imagine.
Oh, my God.
What inspired you in the first place, David, to do this? Why the annotated hashish eater?
I've always been interested in the mind and how it works and, questions of, the mind-body problem and where the spirit is tangent to the body and kind of bizarre things that you think about when you're just sitting around philosophizing, staring at sunbeams. And in the course of this, of course, I became very interested in chemically induced altered states of consciousness and how that gives you a wonderful tool to analyze your own mind and how you perceive things and how the world of sensation and perception works. And so when I went to a used bookstore about 15, 20 years ago and saw a copy of The Hashish Eater. This was a 1975 edition. And I thought, well, that ought to be kind of interesting. And so I picked it up and started leafing through it and ended up bringing it home. And I was amazed. I couldn't believe how well he was describing experiences that I had had on psychedelic drugs. And this was 150 years earlier, and on cannabis, a drug that I'd always considered just sort of, recreational and harmless and kind of interesting, but nothing to get all that excited about. But he was clearly describing the same things that I was wrestling with and really curious about and trying to figure out. And he was bringing in so many other resources from the 19th century philosophic and literary and poetic canons and spirituality. I wasn't really raised in a Christian tradition, so I didn't know anything about really what was being talked about issues of the soul and mind-body problem from a Christian point of view, and he had all of that at his fingertips. And so I read through this and I was thrilled that this thing existed, and was surprised that it was so hard to find and so obscure. I thought, well, this is our Charles Darwin. This is our Christopher Columbus or Neil Armstrong. He got there firstest and planted the flag and came back to tell us the tales so that we could figure out, what was next. And so I decided then and there I was going to save this fellow from obscurity, and did some research on his life, went back east and went to his old college, Union College in Schenectady, and managed to find some interesting things in their library. He wrote their alma mater, it turns out.
Wow.
So I got to see some of the original manuscripts of some of the things that he wrote there. And the New York Historical Society has a lot of family letters, and he was, from a biographical point of view, he was lucky enough to have a very, very gossipy cousin who tells us all about his family.
Wow.
And about him, who remained scandalous throughout his life. So, found
did
out
he ever
a lot.
Get married?
I was going to republish this because it needed to happen. What was that?
What, did he have a partner, like a wife or kids?
Yeah. He married the young and beautiful Rosalie Osborne, and this becomes part of this is wonderful when you're trying to look somebody up as a biographer and you find out there's all sorts of scandal and romance and everything in there. He, after marrying Rosalie, he and Albert Bierstadt, who is an artist, and if you don't know about him, he was a big landscape artist in the middle of the 19th century, and chances are one of your high school civics textbooks has a painting that he did on the cover. But anyway, they went back on the overground, I've lost it. He went back west to explore Yosemite and chat with the Mormons in Utah and just sort of check out the Overland Trail with Bierstadt, who was going to be doing paintings of what they saw while he was going to be describing it and sort of working as a publicist for Bierstadt. So they had quite the trip and ended up in San Francisco palling around with Mark Twain and that crowd and checking out Yosemite and the sequoias and beautiful national parks. And after they got back, Bierstadt kind of married Ludlow's wife. So there was a bit of a nasty little triangle going on there. Ludlow wrote a book about the trip back west, and in the articles that he sent to magazines while he was traveling, he was talking about his great friend Albert Bierstadt and how much fun they were having. And and the book that was finally published after the divorce was final, Bierstadt's name disappears, and he's just described as this friend who one time saved me by taking this vicious creature out of my sleeping bag and taking it away. Wow. So he puts in this little fictional dig into his story. There's a lot of bitterness there, as you can imagine.
Wow.
I bet. So I want to ask you now about the book itself, and I guess this is where we'll wrap it up. But I wanted to ask you now, the way that you did this was really, for me, it was so wonderful, because I'm really into history, and I think anyone that's into history is going to appreciate what you put together here, because it's not just the book, it's a whole bunch more. Can you tell us about the whole bunch more?